You are listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss.
Step by step along this march, Candy One, Candy One, many stones can form an arch, singly done.
Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum, a weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City. This show is produced by a team of volunteers from a broad range of workplaces and unions and is sponsored by the Institute for Labor Studies at UMKC. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI, UMKC, or any of the unions involved. Tonight's show is being underwritten by IBEW Local 124 and Teamsters Local 41. The International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers supports the Heartland Labor Forum. We've been wiring Kansas City since 1905. If you're not finding your electrical contractor at IBEWLocal124.org, then you're not getting the best value for your money. Teamsters Local 41 is the largest Teamster local in Kansas City and the surrounding area and represents approximately 6,000 members in many industries, including freight, UPS, dairy, food and beverage, bakery, warehouse, car haul, car dealers, car rental, parking, and show work. We help workers and their families achieve and live the American dream. Our members are hardworking, patriotic, caring, family-oriented, and civic-minded, and we proudly support our men and women in uniform that put their lives on the line every day to protect our rights and freedom. We thank our underwriters for their contributions to the Heartland Labor Forum and KKFI. On tonight's show, it's strawberry season, but before you bake that pie, look for the Driscoll label and don't. There's a boycott by workers in Mexico who are paid $6 to $12 a day. We'll talk to David Bacon about the ongoing campaign of strawberry workers in Washington State and in Mexico. Then, May Day is being forecast as a day without immigrants. We'll look at how important immigrants are to our local economy. That's all on tonight's show. In the news, is Trump trying to turn the whole U.S. into Kansas? And new study shows how many federal contractors send jobs abroad. Our feature at the end of the show is Washington Window on Workers. Tonight, we'll talk about Workers' Memorial Day, which is tomorrow, and the future of OSHA. Now for the news.
News from our side, April 27, 2017. Today, Oxfam announced that Tyson Foods has committed to major steps to improve worker health and safety, wages and benefits, worker engagement and transparency, raising the bar for the rest of the poultry industry. Tyson is the largest poultry producer in the United States with 23% of the market. Oxfam said that Tyson's commitments for workers are a win-win-win for everyone involved. Now consumers can feel better about working conditions under which their chicken is produced. Investors and the public will know more about what's happening inside Tyson's plants. And the company will benefit from establishing itself as a market leader on sustainability and transparency, particularly on workers' rights. Most importantly, if Tyson follows through on its commitments, workers will enjoy higher wages and benefits, safer conditions, and more opportunities to engage in the workplace and speak out without fear of retaliation. These changes are the result of a 2015 report by Oxfam on the poultry industry, which found workers suffer from declining wages, higher rates of occupational disease, and a climate of fear and intimidation. A broad coalition of organizations applied public pressure on the industry to set new workplace standards, including rules as mundane as a right to use the restroom. Oxfam pledged to make sure Tyson's pledges are carried out and to take the campaign to other poultry producers like Perdue and Pilgrim. Oxfam credited the power of collective action for this victory. They were part of a broad coalition that worked since 2014, which includes worker centers, unions, and civil rights groups, nonprofit advocacy groups, and a variety of experts with a long experience in government, academia, and the law. Besides Oxfam, they include the Southern Poverty Law Center, the Northwest Arkansas Workers Justice Center, and the Greater Minnesota Worker Center. Of course, many workers who showed the courage to tell their stories. The campaign also got more than 100,000 consumers to sign a petition to the top four companies. The companies were already reeling from a major media exposure of the denial of bathroom breaks. The coalition also filed shareholder resolutions with three of the companies, attended their annual meetings, and pushed government agencies for years to make more action on issues facing poultry workers.
Is Trump trying to turn the entire United States into Kansas? His tax plan, announced Wednesday, bears a remarkable similarity to that instituted by Kansas Governor Sam Brownback years ago. There's an irony here. Last weekend, thousands of scientists and supporters of science demonstrated around the world deploring not just defending of research, but also a regime that thinks that research and facts and evidence don't matter. Now, contrary to all evidence that supply-side tax cuts like Brownback and Trump push work to stimulate economic and growth, job growth, both keep claiming that they do. Kansas Democratic State Senator Tom Holland said yesterday, "I guess history and the mistakes throughout history repeat itself." The rich white guys, formerly from Goldman Sachs, who now represent the Trump administration, touted Trump's new tax cuts yesterday as all about creating economic growth and jobs. So let's take a look at how well Brownback's January 2013 tax cuts worked to generate economic growth and jobs. Luckily, the Kansas City Star published the results today. From January 2013 through September 2016, Kansas GDP, that's the market value of goods and services produced by labor and property located in a state, rose 7.4%. The national average for the same period was 13.4%, almost double that of Kansas. Maybe supply side cuts don't grow the economy like Sam and Don claim. But wait, what about jobs? In 2014, when he was running for re-election, Sam promised us 50,000 new jobs by the end of 2016, and double that by the end of 2018. Unfortunately, we didn't make the first goal. In fact, the job growth has been 0.3%, less than 1/4 of Missouri, putting Kansas 9th lowest in the nation. So what can we learn from this? Forget the numbers and don't listen to the promises. See the tax cuts for what they are, a gift to business owners, especially the big ones, and in Trump's case, to himself.
PAI reports that the top 100 federal contractors, including firms such as General Electric, General Motors, and United Technologies, offshored almost 59,000 U.S. jobs from 1995 to 2015. A new report reveals this, and that may be a large underestimate, it adds. Using U.S. data about the contracts the firms hold, plus federal figures on workers and firms that seek federal trade adjustment assistance, a small program that's supposed to aid U.S. workers who lose their jobs to unfair trade, the report found the height of the offshoring occurred in 2008, the depths of the Great Recession. But the larger point, said Public Citizens Global Trade Watch and union-supported Good Jobs Nation, is that billions of taxpayer dollars are still going to firms that export U.S. jobs, and they shouldn't. The report, called Federal Contracting with Corporate Offshorers Continues, shows the largest federal contractor, Lockheed Martin, holds $43 billion in federal contracts. It also offshored 953 jobs whose workers applied for and got trade adjustment assistance aid. The number two contractor, Boeing, holds $26 billion in contracts and offshored 1,238 jobs. The report said the pattern of letting federal contractors offshore U.S. jobs continues under the GOP-Trump administration. That's despite the president's campaign trail promises and despite his highly publicized rescue of some 700 jobs steelworkers hold at the Carrier plant in Indianapolis. Carrier is a subsidiary of United Technologies, a federal contractor. GE finished first in offshoring jobs under the trade adjustment assistance. Some 8,736 GE workers have received the aid. GE holds $1.89 billion in federal contracts. United Technologies, with 5,738 workers who lost their jobs offshore and got TAA aid, was second. It held $6.48 billion in federal contracts. GM, number 100 in contracts, $334 million, was number four in offshoring workers, 5,303, just behind Hewlett-Packard with 5,331 jobs. The communications workers made the point, which the report states, that TAA money, that's trade adjustment assistance, to workers who lost their jobs to unfair trade underestimates the problem. That's because TAA, except under the Obama administration's stimulus law, only covers factory workers, not service workers. So call center workers whose firms have been offshoring jobs are excluded. And TAA relies on workers or their firms to apply for the aid. It also does not cover workers who lost their jobs because those jobs, such as, say, a server in a diner next to a steel plant, disappeared when factories closed and their customers disappeared. That's the news from our site. The news tonight was read by Christina Hendricks, Molly Madden, and I'm Judy Ansel.
Hello, and welcome to Heartland Labor Forum. I'm Jacob White. Joining me today is David Bacon. He's a photojournalist and a past guest of Heartland Labor Forum, who has a new book out this May called In the Fields of the North from University of California Press. The book is an intensive look at farm workers, documenting farm life, living conditions, culture, and migration through over 300 photographs and many narratives of workers themselves in both English and Spanish. David, thank you so much for joining us on Heartland Labor Forum today. Tell us a little bit about recent trends in labor migration among farm workers on the Pacific Coast.
One of the most important things that's gone on in the last few years has been the migration of people from southern Mexico especially. And the reason why that's important is because this wave of migration that began in the mid-1980s and has continued until today is coming from communities of people that are very old. The culture of people in these towns and communities existed long before the Spanish colonizers ever got to the Americas. And as a result, people are still practicing their culture, and they're speaking languages that were hundreds, if not thousands, of years old before colonization. So we're talking about languages like Mixteco, or Triqui, or Zapoteco, or Purépecha. These are all the names of indigenous languages. And those languages and that culture functions as kind of a cultural glue for those communities. And people maintain their relationships with each other, they maintain that culture, and they know each other, and that gives them an ability to organize and cooperate with each other in ways that are sometimes very, very impressive. So that's kind of who the farm workers are. But that also, that indigenous migration, we're not just talking about the Pacific Coast. If you look at farm workers in Florida and along the East Coast, for instance, it's true. That's what's going on in those states as well, too. I'm not so sure about the Midwest, although I know that there is a very strong migrant stream that comes up from Texas and the border around Texas in the Rio Grande Valley through Kansas, Missouri, up through the Midwest, eventually to states like Michigan. I think that's probably a little bit less indigenous than the migration streams on the two coasts.
And you talk sort of about the journey that that migrant workers make. Sometimes they stay in California and go up to Washington to work and then come back. But sometimes they just go up to Washington and plan to stay there and to make their lives there. So for people who are just moving to Washington from further south along the Pacific coast, what are some of the living condition problems that they face when they get there?
Well, when people get to Washington State, people who are migrating up there for the season, they have to find housing very quickly, because usually people are traveling with their families, so they have children and they have a whole family group that's traveling together. So what happens is either they get housing that's provided by the growers, and sometimes that housing can be in very poor condition, or they have to hustle for their own housing, which is very difficult because people are going to rural areas, meaning that they're going to small towns where there's not a lot of places that people can rent that's available for people. So sometimes people wind up living in garages or packed together in motel rooms or even in their cars or living out of doors. And that, you know, that's not just for people that are traveling from, say, from California up to Washington State, but it's also true for farm workers in California. I've seen many, 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 many times people living in, you know, in housing conditions that remind you of the photographs that we see of the farm workers during the Depression.
Many of these workers are in the berry fields, or they are generally in the berry industry. Can you talk a little bit about what the berry industry and its distribution network looks like in the 21st century United States? Is it very concentrated?
Yes, it is, and increasingly so. I mean, you know, if we go back, you know, 30, 40 years, you know, berry growers were generally a lot smaller scale, and they all pretty much operated independently. And while there were some distributors, it was kind of a much more fluid situation. Today, the distribution of berries, in other words, if you go into a supermarket and you take a look at the labels that are on the clamshell, those plastic clamshell boxes that hold the berries, whether it's strawberries or raspberries or blueberries, you only see a very few names, because there are really only about four companies these days that distribute the vast, vast, vast majority of berries to supermarkets around the country. And of those four, by far, the biggest one is a company called Driscoll's, which is located in California. It has its headquarters in Oxnard and Watsonville in California. And they call themselves the world's berry company. And so they are not a grower themselves, although the family that owns Driscoll's also owns ranches and also does a lot of growing of berries. But Driscoll's themselves are distributors. So what they do is they will take berries that are grown by a grower, and then they will take them to the supermarket, and they will essentially act as a wholesaler and sell them to the markets. And they're doing this around the world. First of all, they're contracting with growers in many different countries to grow the berries. And now, for instance, they are exporting berries that are grown in Mexico to China. So they are attempting to become this kind of like world straddling, you know, seller of berries. And that gives them an enormous amount of economic power and influence, to the extent that they control the conditions that the berries are grown in. They can go to a grower and they'll say, you know, we want you to grow a certain variety. We want you to use the following chemicals, or if they're organic, we don't want you to use the following chemicals. And they control the economics for the workers by giving to, you know, by buying from the growers at a price that essentially determines how much money the grower is going to get in profit, but also how much money the workers are going to receive in wages. So in many ways, they are economically responsible for the fact that berry workers, whether in the United States or in other countries, are living in poverty.
You mentioned how the local ties and the traditional languages and cultures that migrant workers bring with them help with organizing. Could you talk a little bit about some concrete organizing that they have done and a little bit about how the ranches have responded?
Sure. In fact, there are three different sort of organizing efforts that have taken place in the last couple of years that kind of really show real clearly what these relationships are like and what workers have been able to do as a result of that. So again, remember, you know, that we're talking about really a single large stream of people that is coming out of Oaxaca, and they are then going to work as workers in various fields in northern Mexico, especially in Baja California, in a valley called the San Quintin Valley, or an area close to the coast there. And then they are also coming to the United States. They are the workforce in their various fields in California, in Oregon, and in Washington. So 3 years ago, the workers in Washington State began to organize themselves at a grower called Sukuma Farms. And Sukuma Farms sells its berries to Driscoll's. So Driscoll's is really the force behind Sukuma. And they were motivated by, you know, they were angry about the low wages. They were living in a labor camp where the conditions were pretty bad. And when they protested, the company would fire people. And so they began organizing work stoppages to force the company to sit down and negotiate with them. The company looked like it was doing that for a while and then kind of stopped. And so in order to force the company to come to agreement with them, well, the first thing the workers did was they organized themselves. So they set up a new independent union for farm workers called Familias Unidas por la Justicia, which means Families United for Justice. And then they, having kind of done their research and discovered how important the connection to Driscoll's was, they began organizing a boycott of Driscoll berries. In other words, asking consumers not to buy Driscoll berries until Driscoll took responsibility for the conditions that the people were working in and forced Sukuma Farms to negotiate improvements and to recognize the union and do that. So the workers at Sukuma Farms, the workers in this new union, they first began reaching out to students in Washington State. You know, they're working about 2 hours north of Seattle. So they went down to Seattle, they talked to students in the area, to other unions, and they began setting up boycott committees of people that would go out to the stores, kind of like used to happen in the old days with the United Farm Workers, and stand in front of Costco and Whole Foods and other, you know, big retailers asking people not to buy the berries. And eventually they began setting up those committees in California as well, too, in Oregon, in Portland, and then down in California, to the point where at one point there, last year, there were about 50 different committees of people that were out there boycotting the berries, trying to put pressure on Driscoll's. They even had a couple of committees in places like Chicago and Washington, D.C., and that pressure began to mount on Driscoll's. And Driscoll spends a lot of money on marketing. And so they didn't want to have this headache, basically. And so eventually Driscoll put some pressure on Sukuma Farms. And Sukuma Farms agreed to a union election, which was held last November. And in that election, workers voted for the union by a very overwhelming majority. And since then, they have been trying to get Sukuma to agree to a union contract, and that's ongoing right now as we speak. In the meantime, in Mexico, in northern Mexico, in Baja California, workers in the San Quintin Valley, in the strawberry fields, they also got angry at their bad conditions and went out on strike. The Mexican government and the government of Baja California came down on them with a very, very heavy hand. There were even incidents of violence against strikers, and it was a very, very sharp, very, very intense struggle. As a result of that, those workers were able to get the Baja California government to make some slight raises in the minimum wage the workers were being paid there. And then those workers also set up an independent union. And they were in touch with the people in Washington State because in many cases they were from the same families. And they were some from the same towns in Oaxaca. And so they kind of knew what was going on up in Washington State and vice versa. And so they got together and they also began supporting a boycott of Driscoll Berries because Driscoll was the main distributor of the berries that they were striking against as well, too. When the workers in Washington State had their union election, they stopped the boycott of Driscoll Berries. That was part of the agreement in which they got the union election and the promise of negotiations of a union contract. The workers in Mexico and Baja California and their supporters in the United States, they continued to boycott Driscoll Berries and to urge people not to buy them until there was some change in the working conditions there. And then finally last year in California, a group of Oaxacan workers, of Mixteco workers in the fields in the San Joaquin Valley, also went out on strike over the same kind of problems, you know, bad wages and bad conditions and abuse by the foreman. And they then went to the United Farm Workers Union, asked the union for help. The union then went and helped them get an election, which they also won by a very, very big majority. And so since then, they have also been trying to get the grower there in the San Joaquin Valley to negotiate a union contract, and this is at a company called Klein Management Company. So what you can sort of see is that there is this current of anger and discontent and organizing going on among these workers, and that they all know each other, and they are kind of part of this same larger movement for economic and social justice among indigenous farm workers all the way up and down the West Coast here.
David Bacon, we've been speaking with, and he has a new book coming out this May. Very exciting. And David, we want to remember one reason why it's important to think about the farm workers, in addition to them being migrants and that being important. But also, could you remind us a little bit about the Fair Labor Standard Act of 1938 at the very end, just to go over another basic thing about why it's important to be concerned about farm worker justice?
Well, farm workers were written out of the federal legislation that affected other workers that gave us, or didn't give us, but we won the right to organize unions and for minimum wages and overtime law. You know, the federal laws, the Fair Labor Standards Act, the National Labor Relations Act, that recognized those rights on behalf of most workers, especially in the private sector, farm workers were very, very specifically written out of those laws because of the power, especially of the big agricultural interests in California and on the West Coast and in the South. And so that's one reason why the conditions for farm workers have been as bad as they are, is because there's so little legal protection. That's kind of made it more difficult for workers to do things like organize unions. In California, in the 1970s, the union won a state law that gave workers the right to organize unions, or the recognized, and set up a legal process for organizing the unions in the fields. And then recently, California also passed a state law bringing farm workers under the same kind of overtime laws that other workers have, in other words, time and a half after 8 hours. But in the rest of the country, those laws don't exist, and so workers really, have no legal protection or legal process in the same way that other workers do.
And as I said earlier, we're hopefully going to get on some of the community activists and community organizers and religious activists who were part of those coalitions who got those jobs done. But for today, I am Jacob White. We've been speaking with David Bacon, his new book, In the Fields of the North, from the University of California Press. Once again, we remind everyone, people are out there picking your berries and all of your produce, so please be conscious of them. And David, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
On January 21st, 2017, while women held a vast resistance march in Washington, D.C., 673 sister marches also took place over all seven continents. On the next Wings, we present reports from sister marches from three European cities, Brussels, London, and Amsterdam. Wings, Saturday at 2:30 p.m.
It's a mighty long road that my poor hands have hold. My poor feet have traveled a long dusty road. Out of your dust bowl and westward we rode. Your deserts was hot and your mountains was cold. I worked on your orchards of peaches and prunes, slept on the ground by the light of your moon. At the edge of your cities you will see us, and then we come with the dust and we're gone with the wind. California, Arizona, I made all your crops, but it's north up to Oregon to harvest your hops. Dig the beans from the ground, pick the grapes from your vines to set on your table, your light sparkling white.
When did you come to America the free? Who are your ancestors? What is your creed? Who is the father and the son and the weed? Where is the spirit that sought liberty? When did you come to America?
Lila Downs with Woody Guthrie's Pastors of Plenty and her version. I'm Judy Ansel. Monday is May Day, International Workers' Day. Here in Kansas City and all over the nation, we'll see a resurgence of marches and rallies celebrating May Day, although the holiday has largely been ignored in the U.S., while celebrated since its beginning in 1886 around the world. The resurgence in the U.S. is in large part due to our burgeoning immigrant population. Listeners might recall that in 2006, anti-immigrant officials in Congress tried to pass a law that would have criminalized being in the U.S. without documents. As a result, hundreds of thousands of immigrants, mostly but not all Latinos, hit the streets in marches that literally took the breath away for a minute from the anti-immigrant crowd. Of course, what then followed were lots of raids and crackdowns by the George W. Bush administration, which scared people back into the shadows. Now comes Trump and his wall and his mass deportation threats and a re-energized Homeland Security operation, and immigrants are fighting back. The first day without immigrants was February 16th. Workers and students all over the country struck. In Kansas City, I went to our final anti-Andrew Pudster rally at a Hardee's in Northeast KCMO, and afterwards I couldn't find a restaurant that was open. Monday's strike promises to be bigger and to be supported by lots of citizens. Stand Up KC, Indivisible, and many other organizations are teaming up with a national worker and immigrant rights organization called Cosecha. Cosecha says on its webpage, the May Day strike will demonstrate that this country can't function without immigrants. By striking, we will win protection and dignity and respect. The fact is, immigrant workers and businesses are deeply integrated into our economy, nationally and locally. I want to start by giving you some insights into the politics and economics of the immigration issue from Economic Update, the weekly podcast by economist Richard Wolff. Wolff starts this segment by debunking Trump's campaign linking immigrants to crime. This comes from his February 20th show, where Wolf interviews Bob Hennelly, an investigative reporter. Here's Richard Wolf.
Let me turn to some of the things you've recently reported on that I think our radio and TV audience would like to hear. Because of Mr. Trump's initiatives in blaming immigrants for a great deal of the difficulties that the United States economy has, and not hesitating to say that a solution to at least some of those difficulties would be found in expelling immigrants, and noting, to be fair, that the Obama administration itself was a major deporter of immigrants, I have been struck by the effort of those who support this, not only to suggest that our economic problems have something uniquely to do with immigration, but to see in deporting large numbers of people a solution. This strikes me as an economist as a classic effort to distract people caught up in an economic system that isn't working, to blame a scapegoat, to blame somebody else, someone else you can be angry at and take out your upset about, even though it has very little to do. And then I noticed that the biggest rationale for doing this is not the economic argument, because in fact, it's a difficult argument to make.
Right.
So it has become the crime argument that somehow, and you could notice in Mr. Trump's campaign and so forth, this notion that immigrants are criminals or disproportionately criminal or impose on us as native citizens a criminal element we wouldn't otherwise have. You've done some reporting. Tell us about
it. One of the things is that I was on the campaign trail and in Cleveland during the Republican convention. So I did see firsthand the very effective testimonials of real live people whose loved ones were killed by individuals who were chronic offenders who were undocumented and in this country illegally.
Right.
There are such dozens of cases, and Mr. Trump did a very compelling job to give these families that are still very much in pain an opportunity and a platform. I wouldn't deny their pain. But there's a deeper reality, and you know, you can only tell these stories, not in the aggregate, but let's get particular. I've been covering the city of New York for 30 years now. Okay, I'm 61. When I first started working as a beat reporter in 1990, there were 2,262 homicides. It's a big number to imagine. In 1 year.
Right.
The last year, 330 people were killed. That's stunning. To get a sense of what that means, 2,000 people, imagine 2,000 pairs of shoes. Those are individuals that did not get killed. This is a reduction dramatically of homicides. What was happening during that period of time? Over 500,000 undocumented immigrants came into parts of New York City that in the 1970s had been laid low by all the exploitative things you talk about capitalism.
Right.
Neighborhoods hollowed out, found value, stabilized neighborhoods, and transformed them. Now, the big challenge is it's become such a successful city, global capital flying out of places like China is now flooding into New York, displacing those very same homesteaders that turned these communities around. This is a city of immigrants. It's a city of immigrants that has thrived and prospered on an historic level because of those immigrants.
Right. So you're basically telling us that not only did the immigrant wave coming into New York not cause or worsen crime, it's extremely the opposite. The reality is, when you look at the numbers, which is in the end what we have to look at, because otherwise we get lost in the specifics of each horrible situation.
Right.
But when you look at the numbers, immigration, and you've given the clue to it, is a way to reduce the problem of crime, because the immigrants have no money, go into the neighborhoods that are the worst
right.
quote, neighborhoods, and bring life and people and community into places that had none of those things.
And family.
And family into it.
And religious values.
Yes.
Irrespective.
And
I may
setting
not
up
be,
their storefront like churches.
So, and what's happened is a consequence also, we've seen it even, I mean, peace is breaking out all over. It's a good news story. We have a situation where at the Bloomberg end of the Bloomberg administration, we got up to around 700,000 stop and frisks. This was a policy started under Ray Kelly. The idea was stop and frisk primarily individuals of color. Less than 10% were ever arrested or even got a citation. We've dropped that number, Richard, to 22,000 a year, and the crime continues to go down. Immigration is a nation builder, not a destroyer. That's my experience. That's what I've seen.
Wow. I mean, it's something really it's hard for me to digest. The stop and frisk, just to remind everyone, was a major political issue. It's part of what Mayor de Blasio used to become the mayor of
right.
New York, his opposition to it, a program deeply resented by the African-American and Hispanic communities right. here in New York.
Also terribly expensive. Over the period of time of Michael Bloomberg's tenure, the city paid out $1 billion to settle tort claims for individuals whose civil rights were violated or where a stop and frisk incident caused the police to overreact. So it was also very expensive from the standpoint of taxpayer accountability.
Right, and it didn't work, as you see.
Right, exactly.
It didn't work. It's amazing, that kind of thing. Okay. You told me an interesting story about immigrants, this time not about crime, but about immigrants and a response by the New York firefighters.
Right, and the construction trades.
And the construction trades. Tell us about that.
Well, there's no doubt that we know historically the construction trades were very slow to integrate. There was a lot of blood spilled in this country by the white supremacist movement, very resistant to bringing in what we know to be a real pathway to a middle class and upper middle class lifestyle. To a large degree, construction trades has taken the place of manufacturing in the United mm-hmm. States because it's something you can do with your hands and it's a trade. What I've noticed in the last few years in New York City is that the building trade started to come to understand that the undocumented immigrants that are in the city that are trying to work in this profession are not their enemies. They're their potential allies. So we see them taking a leaf out of the page of Andy Stern with Justice for Janitors in California, where the SEIU, Service of Employees International Union, had this breakthrough moment where instead of looking at the janitors that were undocumented and Latino as their enemy, they said, hey, this is the future, and brought about a kind of organization that made the SEIU one of the few unions that really grew dramatically. And as a consequence, I think President Obama got in the White House as a consequence, but the SEIU was critical to his victory.
So we cut that off a little early, but that was economist Richard Wolff with reporter Bob Hennelly. They gave us a lot to chew on. I fervently hope that our unions and our immigrants turn out together on Monday to celebrate Workers' Day and to say no to Trump's demonization of immigrants. But how big a deal are immigrants in Kansas City? Well, depends on where you live. My community, Kansas City, Kansas, is 14% immigrant. Yesterday on KCUR's Central Standard, Mayor Mark Holland of the Unified Government of Wyandotte County in Kansas City, Kansas, was asked by host Gina Kaufman how diverse his community is.
Wyandotte County is one of the two most diverse counties in the country. Only Broward County, Florida shares the attribute of having no ethnic majority, and all three major ethnic groups are over 25%. So not only do you have great cultural diversity, you have socioeconomic diversity, and you do have lifestyle diversity. I mean, we have people in very urban areas, and we have cows. Not many cows, but we do have cows in Wyandotte County. So there's a lot of different cultural differences. And when you talk about the community, trying to find consensus among the community is challenging. But my experience is people have similar values. They want a safe community. They want an affordable community. They want a community that has great amenities. I think most people have similar hopes and dreams for what they envision when they think of their city.
When the chief of police in Kansas City, Kansas, responds to the president's call on communities to enforce immigration laws by asserting that the rise in violent crime and drive-by shootings was going to continue to be his priority, what's your role in a moment like that?
Well, I think the first thing to do, and I would encourage everyone in the United States to have a little bit of humility. If you're not Native American, you probably came from somewhere else. Our community is a city of immigrants, and so when we celebrate that, and we continue to be a city of immigrants. Really, the arrogance that, well, we got here so you can't, is really troubling. And the economic growth that new immigrants have brought to our community and to our whole metropolitan area and to our whole country. Certainly, building a wall is a nonsense that we don't really have any time for in Wyandotte County. We are welcoming new people into our community all the time. And we really want to find a way to give people a legitimate path to citizenship or work visas, because there's a lot of predatory things going on.
And that's something that you can advocate for as mayor, or that's something that you, as a citizen of the, are you speaking as a mayor or as a citizen of the United States?
Well, both. I mean, I think it's important that I represent everyone in the city, whether they can vote or not, or whether they choose to vote or not. You know, it's not, when my phone rings at the mayor's office, I don't get to say, well, did they vote in the last election? I don't care. I represent the whole city, and if a large number of my community needs my help or my voice, then I think I have a responsibility to advocate at the state level, which I do, and our commission does. I mean, our commission has adopted a very progressive policy towards immigration in counter-distinction to what's happening at the state and in the national level. So I think we have a responsibility to advocate for our people and to stand up and dismiss a lot of the mythology that's being thrown out about immigrants, the negative mythology.
Suppose all our immigrants in the KC metro area go on strike on May Day. Would it make a dent? It's hard to know, but in 2013, there were 134,000 foreign-born residents of the area, according to a study by University of Kansas. The study's called The Economic Impact of Immigration in Kansas City in the Bi-State Region. They found that Wyandotte County has the highest percentage of immigrants, followed by Johnson County at 8.1% of the population and Jackson County at 5.7%. Remember, these statistics are 4 years old, and so the immigrant population is probably higher now. More of our 134,000 foreign-born population is able-bodied than the native-born because they're younger. They are prime work age. Most by far come from Mexico, 41,000. In second place are people from India at 6,000. Again, these are 2013 statistics, and I bet the 4,500 Hondurans who were there then have grown since the surge of teens and mothers with children came, fleeing the violence and poverty caused by the drug war, free trade, and corruption. In fourth and fifth place are the 4,400 Koreans and 4,200 Vietnamese who've been here probably the longest. In fact, two-thirds of our immigrants in the Kansas City area have been here for over 10 years, and most of those speak passable English. Immigrant men virtually all work, 95% of them, and most work at jobs that pay little but are essential to the economy to work. Top jobs for immigrant men and women in Kansas City are cooks, janitors, housekeepers, and maids. After those, the most common job is computer software developer. Many of those workers probably aren't immigrants. They're here on temporary H-1B visas, the kind Trump just threatened to cut. We'll see if he does. In Kansas City, Cerner, Sprint, and Black & Veatch have over 600 visa workers between them. Another thing is that immigrants are slightly more likely to be self-employed. And of course, if you check out Kansas or Central Avenues in Kansas City, Kansas, or Independence Avenue in Kansas City, Missouri, you see formerly run-down parts of town with new, vibrant business cultures. And you know exactly what the reporter on Wolf's show was talking about. Immigrants have rejuvenated many hollowed-out parts of town. Interestingly, the KU report concludes that Kansas City could actually still grow and wages would be fine with more immigrants. Seems like we should all be passing resolutions in our city councils for safe and welcoming cities. That's what we now call sanctuary cities, since Trump threatened to punish cities who value their immigrants rather than aid in deporting them. Of course, that scheme of the Donald has been blocked by the courts. So let's welcome and value our immigrants and protect them from the hysteria of the ignorant. And don't forget to celebrate the great diversity of our population and the people who cook our food, clean our buildings, fix our roofs, and put up drywall, along with taking care of our kids and many other things they do for us, often for very low wages. You can show your appreciation by turning out at 5 o'clock p.m. Monday to Barney Ellis Plaza at 12th and Wyandotte downtown for the May Day rally in March. Heartland Labor Forum will bring you coverage of the May Day strikes and demonstrations in a few weeks. And don't even think about going out for Mexican food on May Day. This is Judy Ansel. Hi, and this is Washington Window on Workers with Mark Grunberg. Are you there, Mark?
I'm here. Thank you.
Ooh, okay. You just burst in just like that song did. So we want to talk about, actually, tomorrow is Workers Memorial Day, day to honor and mourn the workers who died on the job. And you've written a really interesting and extensive article this week about a new study that was done by the AFL-CIO called Death on the Job Report. Tell us about it, Mark.
Well, it's their annual Death on the Job Report, but this time they focus not just on the deaths and injuries on the job and the deaths and injuries. The injuries have been going up, and the deaths have pretty much leveled off. Certainly the rate of fatalities on the job has leveled off. It came down to ever since 1970, since OSHA passed. But the last couple of years, it's pretty much leveled at three to 3.5 workers killed per 100,000 workers on the job. But the interesting thing they talked about was all the progress that has been made over these last 40-some-odd years with job safety and health and how much could be undone by the Trump administration and the Republicans in Congress. We've already seen at least one OSHA rule thrown out for good, and that's the one that requires companies to keep records of on-the-job injuries and deaths for 5 years rather than 6 months. There are other rules that are up for grabs that could be tossed out, one that protects workers against exposure to beryllium. Another, which protects workers against exposure to silica dust, both of which cause cancer. Silicosis is like black lung disease. You know, once you get it, you're in terrible pain for the rest of your life.
So,
and the Trump administration wants to basically stall them, if not toss them.
So, okay, so Trump wants to deregulate some of our health and safety standards. Doesn't he also want to cut the budget for OSHA and the Department of Labor?
Well, he hasn't gotten specific about OSHA. But what he has proposed is a 21% cut for the Department of Labor. So, OSHA this year is scheduled to get $552 million. That may sound like a lot of money, but it's not. There are 8 million workplaces to be inspected in this country. So you have an inspector coming around to a workplace once every 159 years or so, which is terrible. you cut that $552 million by 20%. $110 million, and you're going to be laying off inspectors, you're going to be not having follow-ups, you're not going to be able to have training for workers in how to avoid problems, and so on, and so on, and so on, and so on. In short, more workers would die.
Right.
And that's the conclusion of the report.
Okay. So just a couple more details about the report. What kind of workers tended to suffer the most deaths and injuries on the job?
Workers in three occupations: transportation, agriculture, hello Kansas, and one other, it wasn't healthcare, but healthcare was fourth.
Well, I thought construction is always one of the leading ones.
Construction was the third one, and deaths in construction went up last year from 9.8 per 100,000 workers to 10.1 per 100,000 workers. That's more. If you notice, that's more, almost triple the rate for deaths in all occupations, which is 3.4.
So
those are the three big ones.
And One of the things I noticed
Latino is... Latino workers.
What?
That's the other one. But Latino workers. The number of Latino workers killed on the job went up by over 15% last year.
Wow.
From 804 to 903.
Did they have any explanation for that?
The Latinos are in those three occupations.
I see. Well,
you go to Texas. Half the construction workers are Latinos.
Mm-hmm.
You go to Missouri. A good hunk of the laborers are Latinos.
Right.
Not to mention the truck drivers. Not to mention those who bring us our food on the table.
Of course, and many of those Latino workers are working without union protection, and not even getting paid for the work they do. So, we're out of time, Mark. Thanks for that chilling report. And we should all take a minute to remember those workers tomorrow on Workers' Memorial Day. We'll talk to you next month.
Yes.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you.
Bye.
On the Heartland Labor Forum, there is a calendar. There is one change. People's Climate Rally is going to be at Unity on the Plaza. I hope everybody knows where that is, from 1 to 3 p.m. They may have, weather permitting, they may have a short march starting at the Cancer Survivors Park.
What day is that, Molly?
Saturday, April 29th, 1 to 3 p.m. The May Day rally in March, supporting immigrants, Fight for 15, United We Stand in Resistance, Monday, May 1st, mobilize 4 p.m., rally 5 p.m., march 6 p.m., Barney Ellis Plaza, 12th and Wyandotte. Jobs with Justice Organizing Committee meeting, Tuesday, May 2nd, 6:30 p.m., All Souls, UU Church, 4501 Walnut.
Thanks, Molly, for the calendar. You can find our entire calendar on our webpage at heartlandlaborforum.org, where you can also find our archived shows and our upcoming schedule. Tune in next week to the Heartland Labor Forum. Our show is called Why Trump Won, a panel discussion by labor educators. And thanks to tonight's engineer, Lincoln Dreyer. Stay tuned for the Thursday night special.
You have been listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss. We are sponsored by the Institute for Labor Studies at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Our volunteers come from a wide variety of workplaces and unions. We are supported by many Kansas City area unions and the AFL-CIO. To talk back to us, to volunteer, or to let us know about news or events, call us at 816-235-1470 or go to www.heartlandlaborforum.org. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI, UMKC, or any of the unions involved. Tune in every Thursday evening to the Heartland Labor Forum at 6 o'clock or to our Friday morning rebroadcast at 5 o'clock right here on 90.1 FM KKFI.